Welcome to the Unconquered Podcast.
Lethal simplicity. I like to score fast. It's hard not to be a nose fan. Get Florida State back. I want a damn good defense. We're still undefeated. Blame no one. Make no excuses. Do something.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Unconquered Podcast. As always, this is your host, Jason Staples. It's been quite a while. I've gone on a little pre-spring break or pre-spring practice vacation. This is the time of year when there's really not a whole lot happening, and a time when I'm letting any sources that I talk to generally have plenty of a break, and I take a break, and I'll kick up a little bit as we get into a little bit more that we find out during spring practice. But it's nice to have a little bit of a break and not really have to worry about doing any recording for the last about week and a half. Well, I think this the last episode I put out was over a week and a half ago. So it's about time for another one. Through the rest of the off season, I'll probably do about one per week. There's just not a whole lot more to talk about. I don't want to release episodes that are worthless, that you know, just talk. So I'll do that unless there are a number of questions that come in. I've actually contemplated doing shorter mailbag shows. So if you have questions, I may just take one or two questions and do, you know, a 10-minute episode here or there, 15-minute episode here and there, instead of doing full length during the off season, as a way to maintain some contact with y'all, but not give you stuff that you don't really need to listen to, because there's just not much that's going to be going on in the off season, at least ideally. I mean, generally speaking, anything that's happening in the off season is going to be bad. So in the absence of dismissals and things like that, I'll continue to do roughly one full length episode a week. And this will be obviously this week. So we're going to do a few more mailbag questions that I've been sitting on, a few that have come in over the last week or so, and a few from before that. But before I do that, I once again want to thank Luis Marquez from Keller Williams Realty in Jacksonville, Florida, for his sponsorship of this show. Means a lot. Definitely a diehard Seminole. If any of you have any real estate needs in the greater Jacksonville area, Luis is the guy you want to go with, particularly if you're going to sell a house. Listen, he'll work his tail off. Nobody's going to outwork him finding you a house if you're moving to the area. But if you're selling the house, nobody is going to make your house look better and give you a better online presence than what Luis does. I've seen his work. He is professionally trained. You're going to have smooth walkthrough video. People are going to be attracted to, people are going to want to walk through your house if you have Luis stage it and make sure that he does the photography and videography. You want to go through Luis to get your house sold as quickly as possible. Once again, want to thank him for the sponsorship of the show, and we'll go ahead and move into the mailbag here. Now, following are some questions that I've been sitting on for over a month now. It's one of those issues that it needs to be discussed, but it's not a fun discussion, and it's something that that takes some clear thought, and it's unfortunate that it needs to be discussed at all. But these questions are really good ones, and I wanted to address these questions before spring practice started. No better time than the present. And these questions specifically address the matter of race, so I'll just go ahead and jump into these questions. So first is from, and I'm going to keep these anonymous, so I'm not going to mention the name. Hi, Jason. Recently discovered your podcast. Appreciate your direct and forthright approach. I was wondering how well Willie Taggart's hiring and the racial composition of his coaching staff was being received by the big money FSU boosters and fan base. I'm in an interracial marriage, and we lived near Tallahassee for several years until 2010. While the old saying, they don't care, but they stare, often held true, we did encounter some people who did care. Just wondering if you expect a drop-off in booster donations, or will the excitement of an enthusiastic and an energetic young coaching staff lead to increased booster/fan support? Thanks, and keep up the great work. Okay, so I'm gonna get to some of those issues. I'm also going to get to a couple other questions that are related before I get to specifically answering that one. Okay, the next question, and you can tell that this one was asked before all of the hires were finished, but I'll update as necessary as well. The next question. Taggart has made 9 hires. 1 is not African American. Stan Wilcox, the FSU AD, said early in the head coaching search that he wanted to hire an African American head coach. Have Taggart's subsequent hires been a continuum or continuation of that objective, or is this just the way things have worked out? There's no safe place to even ask about this subject anymore, and I honestly don't expect you to answer it. Race questions are off limits now, though the NFL has the Rooney Rule, and if someone does ask, they have an agenda or they are racist. Is this quantum shift in staffing personnel at FSU a good thing? Does it have negative or positive effects on recruiting? What about fundraising booster donations? This is unprecedented in major college football. I would like to be able to ask the question without being labeled, but where do I ask it? I'm a 40-year-old Knoll fan, booster, season ticket holder. I've been going to games since I was 8. I've been to the last 61 consecutive, home and away. I'm all in with FSU and Taggart. Just wondering. If Stan had not said anything, I probably would not even be wondering. Oof. Again, a difficult question. I'm going to try to address that after answering also or reading one more. Josh Newberg mentioned before Taggart hired Walt Bell that Taggart wanted to hire a white wide receiver coach. Do you think he was getting pressure from the administration and or boosters about the racial makeup of the staff? Okay, so those 3 questions lead into what unfortunately I think is a bit of a necessary discussion about race, the current makeup of the Florida State coaching staff, and some of the things that go with that, particularly in the southeast of the United States. So again, these are questions a lot of people have, and good for the people who sent in to actually ask these questions, because I know that there's a lot of people out there who won't even put these kinds of questions in print, even though they're asking them. But you know, I think this stuff does need to be addressed. Now, I'm going to take the last one first. It is true that, as I understand it, Newberg actually let the cat out of the bag on this. And yes, it's true that Taggart was, after making all the other hires on the staff, except for the quarterback coach and the wide receiver coach, was looking at hiring a white wide receiver coach. That's something that he was considering. And that's one of the reasons that he contemplated going a different direction than a couple of the guys he had interviewed for that position. But the thing is, it was not a situation where he was going to hire a white coach no matter what. He wanted to hire the best guy he could, but one of the things that I was told early in the process is that Taggart is very conscious of the importance of diversity on his staff, in the athletic department, and just overall, that he wants to have guys on his staff that his players can relate to in various ways. And he understands that race, in some cases, is unfortunately a factor in that for many kids. So what happened is, and this gets to the other question in this, you know, was Taggart's hires being so tilted towards hiring other black coaches? Was this a continuation of the objective to just hire a blacker coaching staff? You know, was that the objective? Was this some sort of affirmative action situation where, you know, he wanted to go out and hire the best black coaches he could? Well, that simply is not true. That is patently false. So that much should not be a concern of anyone. If anybody is concerned that Taggart went out and hired the best black coaches he could and then tried to fill out the staff with a couple white guys just to kind of even that out, that's not how this went at all. All you have to do is look at the first people that Taggart targeted, and you see what the basis of his hiring was going to be. And it's typical for any quality head coach on how that's going to work. Coaches are going to hire generally within their network, and they're going to hire coaches that they believe are the best possible coach for that position, ideally somebody that they've worked with before that has done a great job. Usually it helps to have some sort of working friendship with this coach, and you're going to favor, if you can, a few coaches like that as your first hires. And if you look at his first hires, the first guy he actually targeted is a guy that Florida State didn't get. And that's a white defensive coordinator who stayed at Oregon in former USF head coach Jim Leavitt. And obviously Oregon paid out the nose to keep Jim Leavitt from taking that move across the country. And then among some of the other guys that he looked at for that defensive coordinator position was a white defensive coordinator who's coaching at Wisconsin. Ultimately, he settled on Harlan Barnett, who has a great reputation as the best possible hire that he could get at Florida State. And Harlan Barnett just happens to be black. That's how the process went for most of this. So again, nobody'd be asking that question had the first guy that he was intending to hire as a defensive coordinator signed on. But he hired a highly respected, very good defensive coordinator in Harlan Barnett, who happens to be black. Other guys that came with him, he brought Raymond Woody, who's coached with him in multiple stops. He brought Dante Pimpleton, who's coached with him in multiple stops. And he brought Kelly, Dave Kelly, who's been coaching with him, who's been actually on his support staff at multiple stops and is highly regarded both as a recruiter and a coach. And then he brought Alonzo Hampton, who coached with him at USF. So a number of guys that are guys he's coached with that are network hires. And that's how that works. Race, again, not really an issue with any of those guys. These are just guys that have coached together and had some success together, and you want to bring those guys in. Obviously, Odell Higgins was already on the staff. So when you look at how all of the positions were filled, it really did boil down to guys in network who've coached with him before, who understand his vision, who he believes are outstanding coaches and recruiters. Race is a non-issue. And then when Harlan Barnett was hired, who did Harlan Barnett bring with him? Mark Snyder, white guy. Now, that was not entirely unintentional. As I mentioned, this is something that Taggart was aware of, in that you want to have some diversity on your staff in terms of having some white guys, having some black guys, having guys that different players on your team can potentially relate to. He was aware of this himself. This is not, and this gets to one of the questions that was asked here. This was not a situation where the administration was looking at the hires and went, "Hey man, you're getting a little overly dark there, and you might want to add a little bit of salt to the chocolate here." So, you know, make sure that we have some people that the boosters and so on aren't going to be upset with. That was not a situation at all. This was a situation, though, where Taggart is looking at the staff, and he was so conscious from minute one when he took over this job of trying to get guys that are going to fit well together in terms of chemistry as a staff. So you want to get guys that work together well, that can share a common vision, that fit together in terms of positions and how they coach their respective positions and how that's going to fit what they're doing in terms of scheme. All of that chemistry matters. Guys that see eye to eye, then you've got to have chemistry and who can deal with what kinds of kids that you're going to have on your roster. All of that stuff was central to how he was thinking about the staff holistically from the start. And this was not a situation where he was going to say, "Well, you know, this guy's a better coach than this guy, but you know, I need a white coach, so I'm going to hire him." No, it was a matter of, if all things are equal, I'm going to be considering the large picture, the big picture of how this coach fits in the larger mix of things, then hire the best possible guy that I can. And that's pretty standard. And I think that's good hiring practice. And then after this, you know, of course, Greg Fry, when these questions were asked, Greg Fry was the one white guy who had been hired, and obviously a great hire, again, within the network, both a Florida State guy and a Harbaugh guy, a guy who fits exactly the kind of offense that Taggart wants to run in terms of the experience that he's had. It's going to be, you know, that's a great hire. And again, happens to be a white guy, but that just happens to add a little bit of that diversity to the staff. Now, for those last two positions, I was told that he was looking at that and saying, "I've got a lot of guys on this staff who match certain demographics a little bit more closely than others, and it would probably be a good idea to make sure that I include one more, a little bit more diverse hire. Depending on how this all shakes out, I'm going to get the best guys that I can." And ultimately, he settled on on Walt Bell being a great hire as a up and comer at the quarterback position to be able to help him with game planning and some other offensive coordinator issues. And so that then made it a natural move to go ahead and hire Kelly as a wide receivers coach. So all of that said, Taggart took an approach of trying to take a big picture, a holistic approach of hiring guys that are going to be on the staff long term. You look at a guy like Greg Fry, he may be the offensive line coach at Florida State in 15 years, for all we know. You look at a guy like Walt Bell, he's probably going to be a head coach in 3 years, 4 years. You look at Harlan Barnett, he left Michigan State in the hopes of being able to elevate his stock to be a head coach in 3 or 4 years. But along with that, you have Raymond Woody, who's going to be probably on the staff long term. You have Odell Higgins, who's going to be on the staff long term. Pimpleton, probably not going to be a future head coach. You've got guys that are going to be there for the long haul. And then you've got guys that are up and comers and, you know, are going to provide, there's going to be some natural staff turnover, and you can hire another up and comer in that position. That, again, is good planning. That's thinking big picture. That's thinking about the mix of the kinds of coaches that you have on staff. If you hire a bunch of hired guns all at once and then you have to replace 6 or 7 coaches at once, that can kill a recruiting class. And then that completely stymies your progress moving forward. But if you don't hire any hired guns, you can have a pretty average coaching staff, subpar relative to what you want at your program. So you want to hire a little bit of a mix. You want to hire guys that are going to be hired gun in and out guys that are going to move up the ladder. And you want to hire some guys that really just want to be on your staff for the long haul, because that's the job that they've always wanted. He did a good job with that. So while I do think that the question of how he went about the hiring process and whether this was motivated by some sense of affirmative action or whatnot is a valid question. That really isn't how it went. If anything, there was a sense that he needed to make sure that he hired at least a couple white guys on this staff to make sure that he had a diverse staff, which is something that he believes in. He wants to have guys that can relate to different types of players across the board. You know, you want somebody that can relate to your country boy, which, you know, may well be Odell Higgins. And you want to have another coach who, you know, relates really well to a kid from the inner city. And sometimes that a coach like Odell, for example, can relate really well to either one. But again, you want to have a mix, not just to relate to kids and their parents, but also in terms of the kinds of perspectives that these different guys are going to come in with, in terms of approach, in terms of philosophy and all that. You want to have different types of voices in your room, in your meeting rooms, and that's something that he went out of his way to do. So that's answering the one question in terms of how the hires were made and some of the motivation there. And I do agree, by the way, that Stan Wilcox making it public that he had intended that he was hoping to hire a minority coach, I think that was a mistake. I don't think that's something that you go out of your way to say. I think that actually that can undermine your hire, because here's the thing. If Willie Taggart doesn't have great success right out the gate, then there will be, and we'll talk about this later in the show, there will be people among the fan base and in the boosters who are going to start grumbling that Wilcox hired a minority candidate as, you know, some misguided attempt at affirmative action, and, you know, he made a political hire rather than hiring the best guy. And, you know, that basically you've opened the door for those kinds of rumblings when you say something like that. And so I think that was a mistake. Now, I don't think that Willie Taggart was hired because he's black. I think Willie Taggart was hired because the powers that be looked at Taggart's record. They looked at his track record, not his 47-50 overall record, but his track record of turning programs around, his reputation in the recruiting game in the state of Florida, and his very clearly stated desire to be the Florida State head coach, and history of being a Florida State guy. And they looked at that and they said, this seems like the best guy for the job. They hired the guy that they believed was the best guy for the job. So that, and it happens that he's also black. Okay, that's great. So if that's what you were hoping to hire a minority candidate, then you got the best candidate on your board in terms of how you drew it all up, and you happened to hire a minority, so that's great. But I think it's a mistake to have made any of those comments to begin with, whether behind closed doors or otherwise. Those comments have gotten out, and you know the idea that Florida State should hire a minority coach in order to be a minority, I think that actually potentially hurts Taggart, again, if he doesn't start out like gangbusters, which he may well. The roster is loaded enough that he could start great. But we'll get to that issue in a moment. As for the second question, and this is really, I think, the bigger question, and that is, what about how Taggart's hiring, and specifically the composition of Taggart's staff, how has that been received by the big money boosters, by Florida State fans, and so on? What can we expect there? And I think in general, Jimbo Fisher did Taggart a big favor by leaving the way that he did. The acrimony with which Fisher left has basically, it left such a bad taste in so many mouths that he gave Taggart a longer honeymoon on this, in terms of a lot of Florida State fans, and particularly the more vocal fans online and various media personalities, and a lot of the big money boosters. He basically has, he's a lot of people are just grateful that he's not Jimbo, and everything that he does that's different from the way that Jimbo does things is received as a breath of fresh air. So that in itself is a major favor that Fisher did for him. Actually, it's hard to take over a position in better shape than what Taggart did, because Fisher left him a loaded roster. Actually, again, I've said this previously on this podcast, but the Florida State coaching staff, the current staff down there, continues to be blown away by the level of talent that they walked in with. They're going, listen, we can win a title with this team. We can make a playoff with this team. They think they could, they can't believe that team went 6-6, which, you know, neither can anybody else. But they got left with a full cupboard, ton of talent, and with a team that went 6-6, underachieved the last couple of years, and has a fan base that is just that was just desperate to have someone else coaching their team, given the acrimony and all this. So they got the benefit of it feeling like a rebuild to a lot of people, along with a massively loaded roster. So that in itself is going to help in terms of extending that. But he is going to have to win. He is going to have to win. Again, I'll address that in a moment. But there have been a few things that I've heard in terms of rumblings behind the scenes from some older, in particular, boosters, where there have been some questions that have been asked, and the way that certain coaches have been referred to as, you know, well, you know, he's a great recruiter, but... And great recruiter, as you all know, is sort of like dual threat quarterback, although that's changing a little bit in how that's used. But it's, you know, it's a code word oftentimes for a black coach. And usually it means a black coach who obviously is going to get along better with the black players on the staff or on the roster. But when it comes to coaching in game, is he going to have the intellect necessary to game plan and scheme against, you know, other coaches who are more than recruiters? I mean, that there has been some of that language that I've heard kicked around, and that's something that I don't think is going to go anywhere until Taggart, probably until he makes a playoff or wins it all. I think there's those rumblings are going to be there behind the scenes, unfortunately, because that's just the nature of race in America and the nature of how a lot of these things are discussed. But that said, I do think that from everything I've been told, booster donations didn't drop off and have not. There's been no sign of drop off in booster donations due to hiring a black coach or hiring a black staff. If anything, I've seen the majority of this has been particularly from the younger boosters, but even from a lot of older boosters. The majority of the stuff that I've seen, and it's the vast majority, they've been just excited about the breath of fresh air that this staff has brought, and donations have gone way up. There were a lot of guys that were starting to pull their donations because of a perception that Fisher was was not going to make changes that were necessary, and all these other things. And donations are up from what I've gathered since Taggart took over. And there's a lot more excitement about the general attitude of this staff towards Florida State, and they've played it really well. I mean, they've done a lot of very smart things in terms of embracing the dynasty years, in terms of getting guys like Dion to be publicly pro Florida State, and really to talk Taggart and his staff up to do things like bringing back the digital, though it's not the real thing, the digital spirit spear for the spring game, you know, bringing in this, you know, the retro end zones and all this stuff to really connect with the tradition of Florida State. That's really smart. And if you think about that in relation to this kind of question, connecting to the past and to the legacy that way is a way of demonstrating that, yeah, you know, it may be a little bit darker complexion staff, but this is a staff that is connected to the legacy that you're familiar with, and you know we're continuing what you're familiar with. We're not any different, and really they're not. Again, it's unfortunate we even have to have this discussion, but once again, there are going to be some people for whom that's an issue. And again, Taggart is aware of this. Behind the scenes, he knows that he needs to win. He knows that he needs to have success. He knows that it's not just about him in being a head coach at a place like Florida State, a top five, top six job in the country. He can't afford to fail. He can't afford not to do well. He's got to do, he can't afford to get himself fired. That's not something, I mean, that hurts not only him, but that hurts other coaches like him in the pipeline. He wants to make sure that he shows that he can win just like any other coach can win, and maybe better than other coaches can win. Maybe he's got some advantages that you know, in terms of his background and otherwise, that can make him even more suited to a place like Florida State. He's aware of this. But the reality is, and this is where I think the real danger lies more than anywhere else, is I think that the fact is, and this is very unfortunate, the fact is that every new coach gets a honeymoon period. Every new coach, particularly when you're coming in from a guy that went 6-6 and, you know, disappointment and all this other stuff, when you're rebuilding a situation or reloading, when you're in that situation, you have a little bit of a honeymoon. You don't have to win right away, generally speaking. You just have to show that there's some progress and keep the excitement level up. And eventually the honeymoon expires and, you know, you have to put up or shut up. The fact of the matter is, for me, I think the reality for Taggart is that he Fisher did him a favor in making sure that he had a bigger honeymoon than most coaches who walk into a loaded situation would have. Like I said, Fisher did him a lot of favors in the way that he left the program. But on the flip side, and this is unfortunate, due to being black and due to having a blacker staff, Taggart needs to win and needs to win earlier in order to avoid that honeymoon being cut shorter. I don't think Taggart, and again, this is unfortunate. I think the reality is that, and again, Taggart knows this. The reality is that the honeymoon is historically, and you can look at a lot of different positions, both in the pros and in college, black coaches tend to be given a shorter honeymoon than white coaches. And they tend to be given fewer second chances in terms of getting hired to another place. If they do get fired at one place, they don't typically get rehired as readily as white coaches. White coaches have typically been able to fail one place after another. There's a number of them. I'm looking at you, Jeff Fisher. But you know, the reality is that Taggart needs to go out there and be competitive in year one. And I think realistically, he needs to make a playoff in year one or two in order to make sure that some of those voices that are not going to be saying anything initially, because he's in that honeymoon period and, you know, they're excited about the breath of fresh air, even if they may not have, you know, may not like everything because, you know, they've got certain proclivities. But those voices will start coming out a little bit, and you'll start to hear, well, you know, yeah, this staff can really recruit, but man, their in-game coaching leaves a lot to be desired. When you start, if Florida State starts losing a game here or there, or dropping a game, or especially if they drop a game that is perceived that they shouldn't drop, or start to have struggles, those criticisms are going to start to come out, and they'll come out more quickly. And that's unfortunate. The good thing is, again, I think this staff is this staff is not a staff of just recruiters. It's not. You've got some really good coaches on this staff, and the roster's pretty loaded, so they've got a chance to compete. If he can go out there and compete for a playoff in year one, then he's extending his honeymoon. He's going to quiet some of those voices. If he can beat a Clemson in year one, if he can maintain the dominance against Florida and Miami, if he can make sure that he beats both of those teams, if he takes care of business like that, then all of this stuff gets mooted, and any of those voices, those racist voices that are going to have different things to say, and maybe, you know, donations start to dry up a little bit as the honeymoon period ends. If he takes care of business and that team does what they're supposed to do, or perceived, you know, they win the games that they're supposed to win, and they you know, beat a Clemson, or they're as long as they're able to continue to keep Florida and Miami in their place, those voices are going to be quiet, and the donations will continue to go up. And the excitement, actually, this is one of those things. The counter of this is that as a black coach and a blacker coaching staff, there's actually room for more excitement among the fan base and among potential recruits and so on. The ceiling in that regard is higher because of the perception that, look, we're doing something that, you know, nobody else was willing to do. And so that excitement actually adds into the mix. So, like I said, I think really this boils down to a bit of a, it does make things harder on Taggart in some respects. It is something that listen, this podcast, I'm going to keep an eye on this, and I'm going to monitor this, and I will be one of the first people to take on any comments that start to have that kind of tacit racial aspect to them in blaming anything for the inevitable. Every team, basically every team in the country, is going to lose a game it shouldn't once in a while. And when that happens, if I start to see some of those things, I'm going to call it out. And I think everybody should. But once again, one of the encouraging things is that the people that have sent in stuff about this, they're personally really excited about Taggart. The concern is, okay, well, what about everybody else? And that's a positive. So in summary, I think there's a lot more to be excited about in terms of this, and be proud about for, you know, Florida State's on the cutting edge here. Florida State, in terms of the makeup of their coaching staff, looks a lot more like the makeup of rosters across the country, and looks a lot different from a lot of other big programs. They've taken a step that a lot of programs have not been willing to take. So that's, I think that's a positive. But at the same time, like I said, the blacker your staff, historically, the more quickly that some boosters are liable to turn on them, and the more quickly certain criticism tends to come out. And that's just, unfortunately, that's been historical reality. And, you know, the good thing is, again, I think this staff can come out and really be competitive in those first couple of years. And then this becomes a completely moot question. If he goes out there and makes a playoff in year one or two, yeah, no, nobody's going to be talking about that question. It's a non-issue. So that's the positive. There's a potential negative, but I think the positive overall is going to outweigh that long term. All right. And for what it's worth, I should mention, I've actually had the experience the last couple of years. I've been the only white coach on all black coaching staffs in high school the last couple of years. And my experience is it doesn't make a dang bit of difference. But, you know, once again, the perception can matter. And actually, the funny thing is that at the school that I coached at this last year, which was more of a mixed school, but had an all black coaching staff with the exception of me, they made sure that I was on the sideline rather than in the booth where I'd been at my prior stop, in part because, well, you know, it matters for certain parents to be able to see that. So again, we considered it. We thought about the implications of what that would mean for certain people in the Southeast. We considered it. But for our players, didn't matter. And in terms of how we coached, didn't matter. We had a good staff. So worth mentioning. Okay, a couple quick questions before I go to clear off the deck in terms of this. But before I do want to thank the other sponsor to this show, Resolution Home Loans, Chad and Shannon, Die Hard Knowles, podcast listeners, Mortgage Home Originators with true Seminole speed. Once again, these guys, they'll underwrite your loan up front before you go through the buying process. That you don't have to worry about a deal falling through. And what really sets them apart is their Almost Home program. They'll guarantee that you close within 15 days or the contract closing date, or they'll give you $500 off your closing cost. Give them a call at 844-FSU-LOAN. That's a number specifically set up for podcast listeners and FSU folks who want to deal directly with Chad, who's from South Florida, and Shannon, who's in Tallahassee. Or you can visit fsuhomeloans.com. Information is all in the show notes. Please let them know when you do so that you heard about them from the Unconquered podcast, and that'll definitely help this show out a great deal. All right. Well, and also, by the way, let me know if you do wind up closing with them. Tweet your success story with the Unconquered podcast hashtag, or email me with your success story, and I'll throw in a free item of choice from the Growing Unconquered podcast shop, which should have a new item in it here in the next week or so. So keep an eye out for that. First question is from Michael. This is, when will we know if Xavier Peters qualified grade-wise? That's not going to be until the summer, really. He's going to have to, we'll know when we know. There's not a specific date, but he's going to have to finish the semester well. Word is that he's on good track, but he needs to finish the semester with the appropriate grades and make sure that matches up with the sliding scale. And so we couldn't know until he's finished the semester for certain. So that's going to be summer. All right, next question. Since you've played wide receiver at a high level, I think you overestimate that, but in any case, I've played wide receiver. Is there a big adjustment catching a ball thrown by a right-handed quarterback versus a left-handed quarterback? Thinking ahead in the event that Francois doesn't make it back for whatever reason, and Blackman and Hockman share time. It's a good question, and you do hear periodically some receivers talk about how it is different. I mean, the ball spins the opposite way. So if you're used to catching it from a right-hander where it spins one way and then it comes at you spinning the other way, yeah, it can be a little bit different. But in my experience, it was not significant. It really didn't make any real difference. Once you've caught a lefty, you know, a few dozen times, it stops mattering at all. You don't really notice it, and you just catch it. These guys are working with him in practice. It should not make any difference at all. Now, one thing I will say is this mentioned in the event that DeAndre Francois doesn't make it back for whatever reason. Even if Francois makes it back to full strength, I'm not sure he's going to win this job. Let's not operate under the assumption that Francois is the incumbent and is going to win the job. I'm not sure that he's the best quarterback for this offense. And he's not going to be the best quarterback for this offense unless he gets his act together and really earns the trust and the respect of his teammates and shows that he can lead the way that this coaching staff wants. Again, what this coaching staff is going to want is they're going to want a quarterback who's going to make as few mistakes as possible, who's going to be able to push the ball downfield because they're going to throw vertically a little bit more than Fisher did, significantly more often, actually. They're going to throw a lot more vertical routes and a lot more screens. And less in the intermediate area. They'll have more intermediate area than what they've had at a couple of the stops at Taggart's, a couple of Taggart's last stops, but certainly less in the intermediate area than Fisher called. They'll run the ball more and play action, take shots downfield. It's a more conservative approach in general, rather than taking the risk of throwing some of those intermediate balls that have more chance of getting intercepted and require more exact timing and that sort of thing. But they want somebody who can throw it downfield, throw that deep post, throw with touch, and throw those screens, and do so and without making a whole lot of mistakes, because they're going to put a good load on the quarterback. Quarterback's going to have to make sure that he doesn't make mistakes. And if you look at what Walt Bell said in a clinic at the Glazer Clinic down in Tampa, one of the things that he said, I had a buddy there who was texting me from the presentation, and he said, Bell basically said, what are we looking for in a quarterback? Well, first and foremost, we want a guy that doesn't screw us. So the guy that makes the fewest mistakes, and then he also emphasized leadership and emphasized making sure that kid has the respect of the team. I'm not sure that Francois is going to be for sure the guy that's going to do that. Either Blackman or Hockman could beat Francois out. And both of those guys fit Taggart's offense really well. And, again, Taggart's going to want in his quarterbacks a lot of what Jimbo Fisher looked for in his quarterbacks. So yeah. But like I said, I don't think that the lefty righty thing is going to matter much. All right. Next question is from Quentin, asking about differences between Trickett and Fry. Now, okay, that's worth noting. I've said in the past that I think, and I've long thought this, that Rick Trickett is an especially good interior offensive line coach. He did his best work with the guards and center position. I think that's where he really excelled. And if you look at the guys he developed, Stork, Trey Jackson, Rodney Hudson, some of the guys that turned out best under him, those are interior guys. And if you look at some of the guys that maybe didn't develop it quite as much as what they you would have liked, guys like Rod Johnson, Zebre Sanders, some of those tackles, if you look at the critiques of Florida State tackles by scouts and by offensive line guys that know more than I do in some of those cases, and I feel like I know a decent amount on offensive line stuff, but I still learn a ton from some of these guys. Florida State's offensive tackles tended to waistbend a little bit too much, tended to stop their feet, reach a little bit too much. And so tackle was always the place where you would see a little bit more critique of the technique of trick it guys. Interior guys, you just didn't hear that. So the interesting thing is that Fry has always been a tackle specialist. He's always been a guy. I mean, at Michigan, he coached tackles and tight ends. He didn't even coach the interior. Now, he's coached the interior previously, but under Harbaugh, he coached tackles and tight ends. He coaches the place where we're going to see the biggest improvement in terms of technique and all that. This guy, Fry, is a technician. He's going to really emphasize technique, and we're going to see the improvement at the tackle position. And that's where I think you're going to see the biggest difference. The other thing is that he's not a yeller really in the same way. He's one of those guys that's a lot more bite than bark. And word from people who've been coached by Fry is you better watch out because he will hold you accountable. You know, Trickett had accountability for his guys, yeah, but you know, it's a little different. But again, I think one of the biggest places where we could potentially see some real positives is the development of a couple of those edge guys, those tackles under Fry, which that's really his wheelhouse to have great tackle play. So that's something I'm looking forward to. In terms of what they really need to do, the main thing is that offensive line needs to have a great off-season conditioning. Some of those guys the last few years have come in overweight. They've come in my view, out of shape. I felt like Fisher and Vic Valoria and that staff, I thought that at many points they actually emphasized getting bigger and the size of that offensive line way too much. And I thought that going back to 2014, I this was one of my critiques. I thought that offensive line looked fat in 2014, and a lot of Florida State's offensive lines have looked fat ever since. A guy like Cole Minshew is going to be a lot better at 320 than he is at 335. Some of these guys need to be trimmer, particularly on the inside, and they're going to need to be trimmer and in better shape to play in a more up-tempo offense to begin with. But they need to be in better shape and trimmer in order to avoid some of the injury stuff that they've dealt with. So I'm looking forward to seeing how those guys come into the next year, to seeing what differences we see after a full summer with the new strength staff, and seeing an emphasis on making sure that those guys maintain outstanding physical conditioning. It's not so much about strength. They can stay strong. They can get stronger without putting on all that weight. Some of those guys need to dial back that weight. There's been some in the recently released roster. There's already a few guys that have trimmed a little bit, but some of those guys need to trim down just a little bit more in order to be where they need to be coming into next year. And if they come in a little trimmer, they're going to be less likely to get hurt. They're going to be more efficient in both the run and pass game. I think that's where this all starts. Okay, next question from Thaddeus. Who do you think starts at offensive line this year? With a few guys being able to play multiple positions, do you think that the best five will be the starting five? The talent is truly there for the offensive line to be very good this year. First of all, the last comment is right. This offensive line group, there's a lot of talent on the roster. You look across the board, you got a bunch of four-star guys on this roster in terms of talent. It's going to be interesting to see how much cross-training they do during the spring. I think they're going to try to find the best five to be the starting five. What that's going to mean is going to be interesting, because you know, you've got, say, a senior in Eberle at center, and you've got maybe the most talented prospect, the most talented offensive line guy on the roster as his backup. Does that mean that you have Bavion Johnson playing guard? Do you want to move him to guard so that you get another talented guy out there? And then if he plays guard, what do you do with either Dickerson or Minshew. Does one of them come off the field? Because Minshew can't play tackle. Dickerson might be able to, but he doesn't seem ideal for tackle, and Johnson really can't play tackle. So if Johnson's one of your best five and Eberle actually wins that job, which I still expect he probably will, then what do you do? Well, you know, that's going to be interesting. At any rate, they'll have some decent internal depth there, but I wouldn't be surprised to see Bavion Johnson slide into one of the guard spots, at least as a backup here and there while he's waiting his turn at center behind Eberle. But I do think Ball is probably going to be your left tackle. I think Fry is going to work wonders with him. I think he's going to really benefit from having Fry work with his technique. And right now, my bet would be Kelly at the right tackle position. So if I'm looking at what I would expect, say, coming out of spring at the offensive line, as the offensive line depth chart, that first group I would think would be Ball going left to right, Ball at left tackle, Dickerson at left guard, Eberle at center, Minshew at right guard, and Kelly at right tackle. That's my guess. And you know, if there is going to be someone that's going to win a job in there that may not be on that list of the five, then I think it's going to be Johnson most likely that steps in and does something there. But I'm interested to see what happens with a couple of these backups in terms of where they're able to contribute and who ends up where. But I do think that Ball and Kelly, that's your best bet for the tackles. We'll see what happens with Juwan Williams' development as well, coming off an injury. But they need Ball and Kelly in particular to stay healthy. There's a lot of talent on this offensive line, but there is a little bit of concerning lack of depth at the tackle position. That's one place where I don't think Trickett recruited as well, and I don't think it was developed quite as well. But I think Ball and Kelly, those are two of the most important players on Florida State's roster going into the 2018 season. All right, next question. Nicholas asks, what's your concern level with the current quarterbacks on the roster who have had problems protecting the football from a turnover perspective in the new offense where it is at a much faster pace and needing to make quicker decisions with the football? Could this be a real problem, or is most of the consistency due to youth at the position and being able to asked to do too much above their skill set? Really good question. I don't think that you're going to see more turnovers in this offense because of faster pace. At least not more turnovers in terms of per capita, per play. You might see more turnovers just because there are more plays. If you have 600 plays as opposed to 500, then you can expect 1/6 more turnovers if you're turnover rate is equal. So, but I don't think you're going to see more problems protecting the football in the current offense than you did in the last one. I don't actually think that those quarterbacks were asked to do much above their skill set either. I don't think it's a matter of that. It's a matter of you had the last 2 years a redshirt freshman and then a true freshman who wasn't even an early enrollee as the starters. And then the last season you had that true freshman who was protected by a banged up offensive line and had an unreliable group of wide receivers that was not always where they were supposed to be. I'm looking at you, Noonie Murray. So, and banged up with, you know, like Auden Tate, you know, so not the best situation. All that needs to happen for those guys to really excel is for them to just get some reps in the new system. And the fact is that there's so many areas of carryover that are going to benefit in terms of how they teach the quarterback position, that these guys are it's going to be fish in water from minute one. There's going to be a lot of carryover that they're going to be able to pull over. And there's going to be some things that'll be a little easier in terms of the throws that they'll be asked to make. Again, Taggart's approach on this tends to be a little bit more risk averse in terms of how he calls the game than Jimbo. Taggart does not, he's not quite as aggressive as a play caller in terms of pushing into the intermediate area and some of those things, throwing it as often as Fisher did. Fisher, it was more of a 50-50 guy, 54-46 run pass. Taggart's going to be more, a little over 60-40 run pass. And so there's fewer throws that are going to be made. And then also as a result of the throws that are made, you're going to see a lot more of those be lower risk down the field, vertical throws where it's complete or it's incomplete, and more screens on some of those RPOs where you have a bubble screen package with something, or a smoke screen or something like that, that's packaged with a run play, that you'll see even more of that than what Fisher did, which Fisher did a lot of that. You could see against teams that decided not to press, they'd throw that bubble quite a bit, but you'll see even more of that and more just general wide receiver screens, which again, you're not going to throw a lot of interceptions on those. So I'm not too worried about turnovers. I think this is the healthiest that the quarterback roster has been since 2014 when Jameis Winston was there. They've got three guys who actually have experience in the program and actually have real talent. That you realize that hasn't been the case since 2014. You go back to 2015, you had Sean McGuire and you had Everett Golson. That's not a healthy wide receiver, a healthy quarterback room. 2016, you had DeAndre Francois and a one-legged Sean McGuire. And then 2017, you just had the Slim Reaper. You know, that's not a recipe for having good quarterback play. Now you have Francois with a year of starting experience. You have Big Slim with a year of starting experience. And then you've got Hockman with a year of experience in college and opportunity to learn a college offense. And again, much better tools than any of the other guys that were out there in, say, 2015. So these guys, you've got three options that I think you can win with, which means that if one guy goes down, it doesn't totally destroy your season either. So that's a real plus. That's a real, real plus. So they got that going for them, which is nice. All right, well, that's going to do it for us here today on the Unconquered Podcast. Once again, I'm your host, Jason Staples. This has been the Unconquered Podcast. Thanks for listening.
Thank you all very much and have a great day if you want to.
I made this.